Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Poolside Pass podcast. Today's episode's a special edition, if you like. It was our live episode that we streamed on the 3rd of June 2020 via YouTube. If you're listening on catch up on demand, please don't get in touch on the live stream or using the Twitter hashtag, the Poolside Live, as it's not currently being monitored because this event has already taken place. But do enjoy the episode. Do listen back on some great discussions with John Rudd, Ian Arbogast and Dave Champion. Before we get into the recording, just a quick line from our sponsors, Streamlined. Become a qualified swimming teacher with Streamlined in as little as 6 days. Learn at your own pace and be guided by our expert tutors. You can do your training face-to-face, online in real-time, or a combination of the two. Assessment can be in your club using videos or attending one of our assessment venues. We offer tailored, high-quality support. Quote the Poolside Pass for an extra 10% discount. Hello, everyone. Welcome to what is episode 16 of the Poolside Pass podcast. This episode is special because it's live. It's the first live episode we've ever done. And I'm delighted to be joined by coaches John Rudd, Ian Arbogast and Dave Champion, who between them, I'm sure, have over 70 years of coaching experience between them.
That sounds painful.
Ian Arbogast's got that in mind. Well,
let's make sure you get that's a combined total, not my single. Thank you.
So, just to introduce
them. This is going to be a long one.
Just to introduce them quickly, Dave Champion is head coach at Team Ipswich, having coached the likes of Karen Pickering, Zoe Cray, to international appearances for Great Britain. Ian Arbogast, former director of swimming at Loughborough University and coach of countless international swimmers. And John Rudd, who's currently National Performance Director for Swim Ireland, former head coach at Plymouth Leander, coaching notably Ruta Mala Tuta to Olympic gold in London 2012. So, just a quick outline of the episode today. We have got some set topics. So we're going to be discussing the use of kickboards, managing talent within a program, and tips of putting swimmers on international teams from club programs. But after that, we'll go into a straight kind of Q&A format where coaches that are watching on YouTube can put questions in the live chat on there, or coaches that we've got in the Zoom call with us will also be able to come in with some questions as well. So without any further ado, we'll get stuck into our main topic. On the screen, if you're watching on YouTube, there is a hashtag, hashtag Poolside Live. If you're going to contact us using social media, then make sure you use that hashtag so I can pick up your social media question. Let's get stuck in. So we're going to start with a nice kind of discussion topic on kickboards. I know, John, you kind of posted an article on Twitter a few weeks back about the use of kickboards. Do you want to go into some detail as to perhaps why you don't use them so often?
Yeah, sure. So, well, first of all, it wasn't my article. It was an article that I read, and pretty much everything in it resonated with me because I hadn't used kickboards in certainly in freestyle or butterfly kicking for, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years until I came to this job in Ireland where I'm not on deck so much anymore. And so the things that were mentioned in the article, you know, really struck with me. I would still advocate the use of a small kickboard, maybe a learn to swim type size kickboard for breaststroke kick, because I think it helps drop the hips into a position that sits with a true breaststroke body position for the full stroke. But I certainly wouldn't advocate the use of the larger kickboards that kids just tend to lean on, chat whilst they're kicking, get themselves out of a correct body position, put pressure on the lower back and the pelvis, and generally lose focus on the kick set if you give them such an item. I think streamline kicking on freestyle is the way to go with a front-facing snorkel. I think the same on butterfly, but maybe not in the streamline position. Maybe the hands at shoulder width So they're in almost a catch position for butterfly, which allows the body position or the body undulation, the whole body movement of the butterfly kicking, to be allowed and accentuated without putting pressure on the lower back. And the only time that we dust off, or used to dust off the kickboards and throw them in, is during taper, just so that the guys had just a little bit extra and something that was, you know, kind of a bonus in taper around the psychological aspects of taper. But no, I certainly wouldn't advocate them. Now, we use them for kicking against a vertical kickboard sometimes for power kicking over short repeats, 10, 12, 15 meters. But no, as far as I'm concerned, they're the devil's work and they shouldn't be in any.
So thanks for that, John. Just interested to hear what Dave and Ian think about the use of kickboards within training. We'll start with Dave. Dave, what's your opinion on this?
Well, we've just started. I don't let my guys use a kickboard per se. You know, the sort of triangular finished ones, right? Much, much smaller. And you kind of, it's like a, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a streamlined one, I think. So what we do is, we do most of our kicking with that. Or we do our kicking streamlined with snorkels. Like, we use snorkels a lot. That's like our snorkels, fins would be our go-to bit of equipment. And then, and it's interesting, John says power kick, because that's the other thing we do. We do a lot of power kick. So upright in the water, and it's like, it's immense. If you're good at that, you're all right. But so we tend not to, simply because the reason we started using a smaller kickboard was similar reasons to John, really, in that, like, they just seemed to lay on it. It's like a tombstone. So, like, and it all seemed very casual. It didn't seem to do anything. And we don't really have time for casual. We don't really have time for social kick. So when we're doing kick, it has to have a purpose. And that means it has to be done in a specific way or in an amount of time. So we're the same, except we use those yellow floats. I like those. It makes a big difference as well. Streamline kicking, they can't make the same turnarounds they can with those giant floats.
Perfect. I think, like you say, it's the use of those small boards. I often like to do that now and again as well. I think it just takes a little bit of the stress off the shoulder joint, especially when you've got a big float, can put quite a bit of pressure through. Ian, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's good that we've got three guys here, and it'll highlight the fact that there's differences of opinions, but there's many ways to, you know, get success, because I'm going to argue go for the other way. And remember, of course, I'm dealing with senior athletes. Really, I'm referring to senior athletes. So basically, we would differentiate between kick sets and kick practices. So for kick sets, we would use kickboards. So you're cranking out the sets within a cycle, and it would be phased. So there'd be like weeks of endurance kick, weeks of power kick, and weeks of speed kick, leading into the major meets. And I've never had any problems with lower back problems or anything like that using the big kickboards. Up to 2004, I didn't really do much kick. I either did full stroke or a bit of light pulling, not resistance pull. But 2004, when I went to Arizona to visit the program and Frank Bush, they were doing big kick sets on a Tuesday and Thursdays up to like 4K. And when I came back, I kind of changed a little bit. And we usually had, say, Wednesday mornings, we went long course kick, 2.5K to 3K session, coming off the back of a heart rate set that was on the Tuesday night, which was a short course. So we came off swimming at the kick. And then if you look at, say, kick sets like that, just cranking it out in those phases, or kick practices where you're looking at, what's the reason for the kicking? Is it, you know, is it to increase endurance or whatever it's going to be? Or is it to look at kick rates off the walls, off the turns, on the breakouts? So you're creating practices and skills and drills to address those issues of kick frequency, and then incorporate into the breakouts of the waters, and do your kick practices in many, many ways, which are incorporated in some of the swim sets, and everything's addressing the components of the event through the race profiling. So that's really my take on it.
Just, I think that obviously there we've got differing points of opinion, so whether to use kickboards or not. Can we all agree on, you know, how fundamentally important the use of kick within a program is? I don't think you'll find a swimmer, world class swimmer, that's not good at kick. What are your thoughts on how important kick is as a training modality? We'll start with Ian.
Who are we talking to, John?
We'll start with Ian, and we'll go back across the line.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, up to 2004, I never really did kick sets, to be honest, within the program. As I said, I did swim or a bit of light pull, and kick wasn't something that I did. But then, obviously, I changed my mind and realized that I needed it, particularly for the sprint guys. And my range is probably 50, 51, 2, 4. I can push a bit further, but, you know, probably it's not the 15s or the 10Ks or anything like that. And I'm particularly interested in 50 and 100 swimming and the importance of kick in those areas. And also, obviously, for breaststroke, and the breaststroke guys need to, and again, kicking on the board, I never had any problems with knee problems or anything like that. But again, I'm talking about senior athletes here. So for younger swimmers, I maybe have a different take on it, as John does. But for the senior swimmers, again, it's something that I did use.
Dave?
Same thing really, right? So I probably, if I had the choice, I'd probably kick more. I think it's really important. But like, so for us, we're sort of like, we've got these kids, we're an age group program, right? So like, not like Ian and even like when John was at Plymouth, you know, like he had a big crop of much senior athletes, whereas the kids I'm doing, they're like on their journey. So really, like, my job is to try and equip them for when they get to that. So my job really is just to try and make sure that they've got the best skills they can have. And like you rightly said, I think there isn't many swimmers of a certain level who can't kick. So like, I like it. I think what I don't do, or what we don't do, we don't have time for, is you don't have much time for social kick. So everything we do has a purpose. So like, I just need to get it done. So like, we kick every day. I'd kick every session if I had the time, but we do kick every day. I think that's important.
And John?
He's on mute.
Do I have to unmute him? Is that... Yeah.
I think Ian's muted him.
There we go, John. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened there.
I don't know what it is I've done to you, Jamie, but you keep muting me.
Preempting it, mate. He's preempting it.
So look, one of the other reasons that I like the idea of not kicking with a board, just to finish off the point, I suppose, is you can insist on and prescribe a degree of underwater kicking within the kick set. Mm-hmm. That's much more difficult to do if a kid's holding a kickboard. You know, so rather than go, okay, we're going 12 100s freestyle kick off 140 or whatever the set may be, you can progress that set on much more readily by saying we're going to do 12 100s freestyle kick off 140 and you're going to give me 6 maximum speed, maximum effort butterfly kicks off each wall short course. And suddenly that kick set goes into a new area. It's, you know, you raise the bar, if you like, which with a kickboard is difficult. And I think it's where the backstroke guys get an advantage in their kick sets, because they don't have a kickboard traditionally on backstroke and are able to streamline and butterfly kick off each turn and off each push-off within the kick set. So that would be another factor to consider. I absolutely used to do what Ian mentioned there, which was we used to back up every higher quality set with a kick set the following morning. So if we did some kind of heart rate set or race pace or race speed or something that was very physiologically demanding, which would usually be in an afternoon rather than a morning, then the following morning we'd be on a kick set. And the you know, 2 hours or up to 2.5 hours sometimes in morning sets, you know, we'd be getting in a good 3K plus of kicking, even with those that might traditionally consider themselves to be sprinters. Like Ruta would do a 3K kick set, maybe not all on breaststroke, but she'd do a big kick set. Ben Pryor would be different, but she certainly would be doing that kind of thing. I don't think you can get away without kicking. I think early season, you've got a fantastic opportunity in that first 6 weeks, September, beginning of October, to put big kick blocks in as part of a preparation. It might be something that needs to be considered when we come out of this COVID nonsense and get back in the water, that kicking is part of that process. Because if you're doing it with good body alignment, then you're less likely to injure your athletes having been in the water for whatever, 14, 15 weeks. And you're also probably using the same muscle groups that they've been using, because you've probably been doing a lot of land work with them that's been leg-based. So there's no reason why you can't go back to legs. I also think legs has, or kick sets, don't have an impact on the immune system. So if the athlete's feeling a bit rough, like you've hit them with a big physiological set the day before, you can still go at them on a kick set, but you can't go at them on another hard swim set. That does damage them. And if they're in, if maybe they're coming back from a cold or a flu, then kicking is a good way to get them back integrated in that way as well. And you're less likely to see them back in their, in their beds feeling sick again. If you're trying to get them back in generally. So there's a whole world of reason that you would bring kicking in. And I think that if we don't start it with, age groupers early, you've missed a trick, because youth guys that haven't done a lot of kick in their age group years, and certainly senior guys that haven't done a lot of kick in their age group years, they're going to struggle like hell with it forever. So all of the programs that are 8 to 11 years, kicking needs to be a massive, massive part of the staple diet for the age group program.
Excellent.
Can I just add a little bit on that with what John said? Because I was saying, differentiate the kick sets from the kick practices. So in other words, again, it's easy. It's say on a long course, if you're saying 200s or 300s, you can go with fins, 300 swim, 53, 50 back, and you've got to kick under between 15 and 35 meters every 50. So you're working the kick sets there, and you're getting combinations of what's going on. And going back to the kick boards, John was saying I use it to get the feet in position on breaststroke. But sometimes I've used two or three kick boards piled on top of each other on breaststroke, so you lift the shoulders so the feet are in a good position to get a good hold on the water and catch at that point. Not big sets of that, just a drill to do it that way. Or with breaststroke, using two small boards in the hands like this, so you get that kind of balance and stability and proprioceptive messaging, so that they're having to balance with the small kick boards in the hands in this position, but do the kick, but not massive sets of it, but that would lead into other bits of the set. So it's that difference between kick sets and kick practices for me.
Excellent. I think just highlighting the importance of being able to develop good kickers and good kickers early is paramount, really. So our second topic that I wanted to cover, considering the fact that all three of you have worked with some exceptional athletes, what do coaches need to be mindful of if they ever get a chance to coach a world-class swimmer, in terms of being able to manage them effectively within a group? And I know all three of you have had to do this at various points through your career. We'll start with Dave on this one.
Well, mine's slightly different, maybe, because Ian, obviously, Loughborough, they got great swimmers all the time. So, like, mine was, I wouldn't say mine was an accident, but, like, it was certainly a lot of luck involved in that. So, to be honest with you, one of the good things about me coaching Karen was that as she got better and she got older, then I had to raise my game. So, like, for me, having a swimmer like that is an opportunity for you as a coach as well to, like, keep on top of what you do. So I found for me, it was constantly keeping me on my toes, constantly trying to make me challenged as a coach. And also, like, as she got a little older, certainly I had to be a little bit more creative. I mean, if you're talking about, like, what do you have to be wary of? Like, it's no different. It wasn't for me anyway. I just had to, like, make you get on really well with them. I trusted what she said. If she said, I can't do this, then I trust that was it. I think if you don't have trust or honesty, and you don't listen to what they say, then it's always going to be difficult. So I think for me, that was the thing for us. But like I say, it's not like these guys where they've had people come in, big programs. We're just like a little club in Suffolk, and we just happened to stumble across, we just come across this swimmer who wanted to take a journey, you know. So like, and what she did is took me on it with her, really. So I led a little bit, but I listened to Mel Marshall talk the other day. She was talking about Adam Peaty, and she talked about when he was younger, she was in front coaching, and then she was behind, you know, and then it becomes a partnership. And it was a bit like that, really. As they get more confident, then they have their own ideas and opinions. So it's really more of a guiding thing, I thought, for her. But like I say, small club, different parameters. And also our club was quite good with her. What they did is they let us just do that. There wasn't a lot of problem with people going, oh, you're spending too much time with her, or you do this. Because she was really supportive of what we did as a club. So, like, she would swim arena leagues for us. She would swim Suffolk County Championships for us. And I know people might, like, go, like, whatever. But the fact of the matter is it meant a lot to them. You know, it meant a lot to the club, which then allowed us. It allowed me to go and spend, like, weeks at a time abroad. And I mean, that was the era of Bill Sweetenham. And when we used to go away, You know, like, we used to go away for, like, 10, 12 weeks, you know, a long time. So, like, and that was never an issue. It was never a problem, because then when we come back, the next thing you know, Karen will be swimming in our county relay, and that's okay. So, like, and that was okay. And I think if you can buy them into the club program, that's good. I know John once before said to me, I was listening to John talk about, I think it was Ben and Ruta, and about how they did stuff for the club, you know, like, and they were always around, you know, like, it's part of the family. And I think if you can make them part of the family, then the family are very supportive of them, and that really helps, I think. So personally, it's like you have to be honest with them all the time. You have to listen to what they're saying, just like they have to listen to you. And then I think you have to try and make them be part of what's going on, I think. I don't know if that answered it really, but...
Oh, absolutely. Let's hear from John now on his experiences. If I can find my mouse and unmute him, I'll do that.
There's something going on here.
You're going to need counselling after this, lad.
I don't know what it is. I'm not muting him, so I don't know what the deal is. While I'm waiting for my Mac's doing this weird thing where the mouse spins around, so we'll go with Ian, and as soon as I can unmute John, I will.
I think as lots of the Zoom calls that have gone around of late, or the meetings. And Dave alluded to it right there. The coach-athlete relationship is key in whatever level you're talking about here. So even, you know, for your young guys and everything else, your young swimmers, the coach-athlete relationship and the trust and the belief and the honesty is absolutely key. And it's important to coach the person, but to recognise individual differences, particularly when you've got a big hitter or whatever you want to call it within your programme. And they can be very... exceptional athletes can often be very difficult to manage. Okay, they can be difficult to manage. Not all, but quite often they can be difficult to manage in the team environment. Exactly what Dave was saying there about people, you know, you got to balance it so people are not saying, oh, you're spending too much time with that person, or they're your favourites because they're fast and you spend more time with them. It's very difficult in a normal environment to do that, but you need to be very mindful of that, because your role in the club might not be to coach one swimmer to an Olympic medal. It might be to, you know, to coach everything, especially if the board's made up of parents that's not the one swimmer that's going to the Olympics. So you need to be mindful of your job, of what's going on. And I don't want to hug a thing, but it's interesting that on this study here, which I don't know why you've seen it, but Great British Medalists, and they looked at the characteristics of elite and super elite athletes. And this is the point that Dave said about upskilling yourself as you go along. And here it's got, given that high-achieving athletes may well exhibit extremes of personality traits, it's important that sports ensure that coaches and support staff are equipped with the skills and education to deal with such behaviours. So their behaviours can be difficult to manage in the team environment, to bring them to the general goals and objectives and values of the team, but you need to have that flexibility. And hopefully you've got your style and your model. And if your style, if you're too narrow, you'll miss out people that sit outside that here. So you need to have a wide range of abilities and skills and styles to manage that person and to adjust to that person. As Dave said, grow with the athlete, upskill yourself as much as possible. But I think that you need to always assess what's going on. Again, I was lucky, so I was always about the team, and I had people that went away. So Ben Tintley was very much about those kind of swimmers. So I would say, you go off with them, I'll stay here, because I didn't want to see the team. I didn't want to be traveling around with one swimmer, because I realized the team was too big for that. And so I was quite happy for him to go on those big camps and long trips. But that was a very lucky situation, or a evolved situation.
I think Bill Sweetenham used to say that you used to have to stay ahead of the athlete.
Yeah.
I think that was the expression he always used to say, right? Your knowledge should surpass theirs, or whatever. And it was like, and he made that possible. So, like, I think that's important. So,
actually, I've got it written down, Dave, on this piece of paper.
So John, I know through your time at Plymouth, you had to manage various international athletes through what became a very, very large club program. So what would be your advice on managing those kind of elite swimmers within that large club program?
When you're in Dave's situation and you've got that one guy, and Ian's been very modest there, where, you know, he had a team, but he was also very, very capable and able of producing world-class swimmers within that team, and looking after them and being away on the British team and managing things in Loughborough too. My experience around this is, if you're gonna have that world-class athlete in your program, you have to do right by them. And if you can't, because the demands of the program as a whole doesn't allow you to be the one that sees them come to their full potential, then you maybe have to accept that. And if you can't accept that, you probably need to be in a different program. But similar to Dave, I was able to keep that individual or those individuals within the group happy by A, making them part of the group, but still differentiating to the level where they knew that certain things were for them. And then the expectations of the group were that, of course, if this guy over here is an Olympic medalist or this guy over here is an Olympic finalist, they might get a little bit of different attention. But the mistake that coaches often make is not to respect the rest of the group enough so that they still feel that they're worthy and that they're part of your plans. And even, you know, Matt Cross is on this call, and Matt was part of our coaching team when we were doing this. You know, there would be times when I would say to Matt, look, Matt, just stand on this lane here with Ben and Ruta. They're doing X, Y, and Z. Just make sure they're okay for 10, 15 minutes. And I would just wander around the rest of the pool and just try and name check everybody. And it might not even be a swimming thing. It might be, how did that exam go today? Or is your granny any better? Or how was the dog when it came back from the vets? Or whatever it might be. But it was just enough for each one of those athletes in the pool to feel that John was bothered. And I was bothered, but I needed them to know that I was. And just by giving them that little bit of individual attention, quite often it would be enough to get more from them within the set. Dave's point about staying educated in advance of the athlete is absolutely right. So one of the things that I remember crystal clear coming from Bill, and my experience now tells me that athletes go through three phases. They go through the dependent phase, where when they're younger, they need you to do things for them because they see you as the authority figure and you have the experience. And they like the didactic nature of being told what to do. That's what most little kids like. Then they go through the independent phase where they're an absolute pain because they suddenly know everything. And particularly if you've got a young athlete that's away on international trips and they've been told by senior athletes that they don't need to do as much of this and they don't need to do as much of that and they don't do it that way, right? And that's a real nightmare. Now, you have to stay in advance of that, because if you remain in your didactic do as I say mode, then they either quit you or they quit the sport. So you've got to be coy and smart at that point in time, where you've got to agree with them whilst you're disagreeing with them. And you've got to stay one step ahead of what it is that they're likely to put in front of you. And they know when you're not really listening. Nigel Redmond has a great saying, which is, the worst form of listening is preparing to speak. And they know that when they're telling you something that you know you don't agree with, they can see it in your eyes that what you're doing is you're preparing just to knock them back. So sometimes you've got to let them have a little for you. You let them win the battle so that you can win the war. Now, the third phase is the interdependent phase. And you only get to that if you get through this difficult phase too. The interdependent phase is where you're a team. And the senior athlete absolutely gets that you have a level of experience and knowledge from coaching X generations of athletes before them that gives you something that you can bring to the relationship. But they also know that nobody knows them better than them. So that's what they bring to the relationship. They bring the individual nature of who they are. And between you, you formulate the plans together. So I don't know if that helps, but those three phases, if you want to do cradle to grave or playground to podium or whatever you want to call it in terms of an athlete, you know, you want to pick a good kid up at the age of 12 and still be part of what they're doing at the age of 25, then you have to inevitably go through those phases. And more so with the girls, I would say, than the boys.
Yeah. I think...
Yeah, I mean, I think I would totally reinforce John's point about, you know, managing your style as they grow through this continuum in these different phases and be ready for it, because it does take managing and it's not easy. So people think, Adam Peaty, he's easy. He's easy to work with. That none of them are easy to work with. They're very different. They're special. That's why they're different. That's why they're as good. There's nobody else like them in the world a lot of the time. And so therefore, again, not all, but if you look at the different sports, say like, can you imagine managing Lewis Hamilton, Toto Wolff has a hell of a time, or Eddie Jones with Turiangi in the rugby? You know, their behaviours, they do things sometimes that you might say, oh, well, I'd throw them out of the team. Really? You know, the best driver or your best player. So it is managing that situation. If you're too narrow, as John says, they'll be out the door or they'll quit. You've got to be flexible, even though sometimes you don't really want it, you know, we all have our limits for sure. If they're outside of these parameters, then maybe it's not the place for them. But if again, have some bandwidth there so you can cope with these individual personalities. And it's not an easy situation, but it can be done.
I think just going back to that kind of the three phases that John was talking about, I think if you look at some club programs, you can definitely see where each of those phases fits in with different squads and different within the structure. So it's interesting to hear him put it out there in a three phase kind of approach, and I like that a lot. So the final...
Jamie, you also see where the coaches don't have the bandwidth that Ian's talking about, because they don't have any sort of swimmers over the age of 14.
Yeah,
they're swimming somewhere else or they've quit. So unless you can evolve with the athlete, you're resigned to coaching a particular age and ilk of athlete. It's that simple.
Yeah. I think it's really important that the coaches evolve with their athletes, as we've alluded to here. So the final preset topic I want to cover today before we open it up to a question and answer forum is you've all put swimmers onto international teams, working within club environments outside of perhaps a national governing body, a national centre. I can imagine for a lot of the coaches listening, it's an aim they want to achieve one day. What are some things coaches can do to help increase the likelihood of that happening? Because it's still possible even today with our national centres. We'll start with John.
You need the infrastructure to allow that to occur, and you need the level of knowledge and experience for you to deliver within that infrastructure. I would say they're the two key things that, there's again, two kinds of coaches that that are frustrated. There are those that have the knowledge and the ability, but they don't have the program in which to apply that knowledge and ability. And then there are those that have the program, but their knowledge and their ability doesn't meet the resource that's available to them. And they're the two types of coaches that don't quite get athletes onto international teams, or certainly don't do it regularly. And if they do achieve it, quite often it's through athlete talent rather than program or coach delivery. So I would say the fact that you're on this call today, you're an open book, and you need to continue being an open book, and that there's never a point where you stop learning. There's never a point where there isn't something new that you can pick up. There are no secrets in swimming anymore, and there are no people that are going to, not many people anymore, that hide what it is that they're doing and think they've got some kind of magic swimming elixir that nobody else knows about, because that's not true. And I would say that if you're open to knowledge and to redefining yourself and throwing last year's logbook away and starting again, then the next thing you need is you need a program that's supportive of you in developing the resource that you need. So you need hours. You need hours at the right time of the day. You need short course and long course if you can get it. Just having one rather than the other, for me, is a problem. I think all long course is worse than having all short course. So you need a little bit of both. You need a strength and conditioning program in place. You need sports science and sports medicine support for those kind of athletes. And that doesn't mean that you suddenly need to go out and hire a bunch of people, but you need to start thinking laterally. Tap into your local university, see if there are some students there that are interested in bolstering their CVs and working with you. And then you need your line manager, whether that's your committee or your board, to have the same vision as you, so that when the opportunities come along, they're not going to drop in front of you, yeah, well, we pay you to run the club, and therefore you're not going to go away with the British team or the English team or whatever it may be. And you need to have that. You need to have those conversations early, particularly if you see the talent where that's going to be, where that's going to be the one that's going to suddenly make you open and available to be on your first European juniors or your first European Youth Olympics or whatever that might be. So I would say those are the things, the key building blocks that you've got to have in place.
Ian, what are your thoughts on putting swimmers onto senior or junior international teams from outside of the centre?
I think we've covered a lot of the points already, but I think, as John says, you know, pay attention to your professional development and seize opportunities to upskill and increase your knowledge in a lot of areas, a wide range of areas. And again, going back to that thing that Dave pre-mentioned, I had written down, Bill said your experience and knowledge should be ahead of the athlete, from Bill, and or learn from the willing to learn from your athlete. James Gibson's very good at that, and he flagged that up just recently in one of his Zoom talks, I think. James is very good at taking on board and giving the athletes the rein and learning from them, because that's one of the great things as well. You know, nothing is more satisfaction than you look at somebody swimming, because we think it's us that does it, but sometimes you look and you go, how did they do that? You know, it goes against what you think, how they were going to swim, but all of a sudden they dig out something, and then you could learn from that. How's that happened? How's it been done? Again, John's point, let the athlete flourish and grow through the various stages of their development and their career. So you need to be mindful of that. Keep that positive coach-athlete relationship as they grow through the stages of their career. Be supportive and trustworthy and reliable and committed. And consistent, all those kind of phrases, so they know they can rely on you. They know you're going to be there in the bad times and the good times. All right, so then treat them as people. They're not a body that goes up and down the pool, and your respect and care for them doesn't depend on how fast they swim the 100 free. You are there for them all the time. I think Mel was saying sometimes it's an arm around the shoulder and sometimes it might be a kick up the pants, but it's getting that right balance, right? And if you make a mistake, hold your hand up and say, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done that, you know, da, 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 da. So you need to look at those kind of areas. And I would just say, enjoy the ride. Just enjoy the ride as you go through through the different stages, because you know, you're already coming on these things, upskilling yourself, learning new things. And as John says, don't be frightened to try new things. People say to me, oh, well, you didn't say that 2-3 years ago. And I said, well, I hope I'm better now than I was 3 years ago. I'll maybe change. I'll do something different. I'll try a different approach. So that's what I would pass on to the group, where you have that flexibility.
Dave.
There's nothing to say, really, is there? I will say this. First of all, right, I was looking at the question you wrote down, and it says, have you got any tips how coaches can increase the likelihood of this happening? And I'll tell you what, the thing that springs to mind when I read that is, I remember, and we talk about Bill all the time, right? Every one of us has referenced Bill. That's because I think when he was here, he had a big influence over a lot of coaches. You know, he gave opportunities. But one of the things he used to say, like, it doesn't matter if you've got a champion swimmer now, right? He goes, if you do the right thing, if you do championship coaching every single day, then a champion swimmer will come along. And I think if you do the right things every time, every day, no matter what swimmers you've got, if you're doing all those things these guys have said, if you're doing them, if you're diligent, and if you're right, if you're really trying to push yourself forwards, then the right thing is going to happen. The one thing I would say, which Ian was talking about, which is like, you know, like, enjoy the journey. But I'm like, all the time you see it, especially on Twitter, is they have that graph, and it's a, this is what talent looks like, or progress. And it's a, like a jog, and it's the same thing. And what you have to do is, if that was your swimmer, you'd say to them like, oh, you know, it's just the journey, it's up and down, but it is for us as well. So it's not going to be a straight line, and it's not going to be euphoric for the whole thing. Sometimes you're going to think to yourself, like, what the hell? But the thing is I think if you do the right thing, and you're doing the right thing all the time, and you're honest, and you're like workmanlike, then you're going to get a result eventually. Just have to hang in there and pursue it. But what I would say is, I mean, John said about moving to a program, and that's true, right? But I think what you need to do is you need to give yourself a bit of time. Don't be one of those coaches who's a year here, a year there, hunting out the golden swimmer, because there isn't a golden swimmer, right? It doesn't work like that, right? They come, they develop, and they move. That's what you've got to do. You just got to try and be a part of that journey and not try and hunt out the one that you think is missing. So I think give yourself some time. Like Ian said, enjoy the ride and then do good work day in and day out, and you can't go wrong.
Excellent. I think anyone listening, I certainly learned a lot already from these three topics covered. What I want to do now is we've got a brief opportunity to open up some general questions from viewers. I want to get through as many of these as possible, so I'm going to ask Dave, Ian, and John to try and be as quick fire as possible where they can.
That means shut up, John.
So what I'll do is I've got one question that came through on the YouTube chat already, so I'll quickly flick over to that. It's from Neil Hamp. Question, John, you said to me almost a decade ago, potential means nothing until it's realised. Since then, you've taken up a role of performance director in Ireland. Do you believe the same applies to coaches?
Yeah, it's even more true when you're a performance director and you're frustrated a little bit with maybe athletes that are showing great promise, but you know that their restriction is going to be the program that they're in, particularly in a really rural country like ours, where clubs find it difficult to get you know, certain hours in the pool and maybe restricted by morning access only and don't get a great deal of afternoon access and those kind of things. So, you know, there's 1,000 kids that we've seen with promise. Hey, look, this is another story, but I coached two female breaststrokers that I think in many ways were better than Ruta. But she just hit the middle ground of what those two guys had. The potential that the other two had was never realised. And you know, and still eats away at me today in many ways. So yeah, it's absolutely true. Potential is nothing unless it's realised. How many times have we all seen someone where you think they're going to be the next wonder kid, and by 14 or 15 they're swimming the same times, and at 16 or 17 they're either swimming slower or they're done. So we've got to do the right thing at the right time, put the right resource in place, and yeah, it's a very true statement.
So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to unmute all the coaches within the Zoom call. If you want to remute yourself, feel free. We had a question. I had a question come through on the Zoom chat from Chris Littler. Chris, do you want to come forward with your question?
Yeah, some great thoughts and opinions aired already. Love it. Ian mentioned the use of kick across different distances, particularly in his experience from 50 through to 400. Just everyone's thoughts around kind of the technical differences and also the importance and utilization of kick across different distances.
I can go first. I tell you what, I have not got the depth of those boys, but I tell you what, we used to have a physiologist work for British Swimming called Tim Kerrison. And Tim Kerrison did a lot of work on reverse periodization. And one of the things that he came up with was a thing called secondary removal. And like John and Ian were talking about how they would do their quality work in the evening and the next morning they would do big kick sets. And Tim was also a big, what he did, we would do a big set. And then what we would do is, so while the lactate was still like swishing around, then they would do a secondary removal. So you'd have the max kicking after and all different distances. And I thought that was really good. That made a big difference to us because normally what you do is you do a big quality set and then the kids would let go and then it would sort of be over and then there'd just be some easy or whatever. But like when you start bringing in that kind of kicking after, I thought that was a big game changer for a lot of people when people started doing secondary. But it made a big difference because when you're coming down the last 50 and things are getting ugly, you need to be able to kick. And that was one of the things that relay to people that it doesn't matter, you still got to be able to get going. So like we certainly do that still. And when we're talking distances, I remember like Ian Turner being at Loughborough, and I think it was every Thursday morning or something like that, they would do 8 400s kick best average, something like that. So I think kicking is what you make it. I think it's one of those things where it's like, you're the coach, you've got to be creative, you know, like you've got to make it, you've got to sell it to them. I think that's just my opinion though, but you know.
When, Tim Kerrison was very influential for us, and he said, oh, you guys do a reverse periodization program. And we never knew what it was called. We just did this, kind of that speed up approach. Now it sounds great because we know what it's called, but we just kind of invented it in some ways, or we might have heard it somewhere, I don't know. But going back to the kick question, we got a lot from Tim, and one of the things we got was looking at the components of the event, breaking the event down almost like the race profiling, getting to the finer detail. And you know, okay, we can use examples, but I'll give you one example of the importance of as I said, a kick practice. Looking at kick frequency. So somebody like Amy Smith back in the day, who was a sprint freestyle girl, her first 25, my thoughts was, how is she going to beat Fran Halsall? She gets left for the first 25. So you might look at the start, you might look at the positioning. But then when Johnny Skinner was involved, and I know you've heard him talk about different things, and he had the naval architects guys from Southampton come up and tore them on the end of a tether and look at the different speeds and the flow and the kick frequencies. And from that, we picked up that Amy needed to, a kick frequency needed to be 150 kicks a minute and off the start for the underwaters into the breakouts and where the breakouts would be. And so therefore we put practices in where she could kick at 150 kicks a minute. So in other words, it was something like 1 minute vertical kick, 1 minute vertical kick, hands on chest, hands up for the last 10 seconds, getting 25 kicks in the last 10 seconds, like that, fly kicks. So 6 times 25 is 150. So she was kicking at 150 rate, and then we would transfer that to dives. So you're getting that specificity of training for the individual and for the component of that event. So that's what I was saying about before, the kick practice versus the kick sets for energy systems, more the kick practices. I don't know whether that answers your question a little bit, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I heard Eddie Reese speak about something similar with dolphin kicking underwater, the frequency of it. So, yeah, kind of chimes in with that. Cheers.
So, any questions from people on watching on YouTube or within the Zoom call? You can come forward now. So, a question from Mark Skimming. One point, Mark, do you want to Do you want to say that? Cause
do you not want to insult their ages there, Jim?
No. Cheeky.
Alrighty. Guys, you've all done a sort of fantastic job over 20, 30, 40 years. Now you can take that whichever way you want to do it.
That's all you, Ian.
But what one point would you tell yourself now, back that 20, 30 or 40 years or 60 years, Ian?
Love you lots. I think when I look back, I think, and I, once somebody asked me this question and I used the word disservice and they pulled me up on that, and later on they said you shouldn't use that word, you didn't do a disservice, because I said, well, I probably did a disservice to these guys, the sprint guys, because they said, no, you only had a 4-lane 25 meter pool and you had a whole range of people in it. And then back in those days, I was into cranking out the meters and getting that work in, and because what happened then, I used to look and listen to things and hear all at conferences, oh yeah, we do 70K a week or we do 80K a week, we crank out the meters. And I believe that kind of stuff, you know, like everybody does this, that's what must happen. One size fits all. So if I could, I would tell myself to be a little bit more open-minded with things and see that there are many ways to the podium. And then what I did was in the early days was go visit lots of programs to actually see what goes on. And that's what I would say to you guys, that if you get the opportunity to go and see programs rather than just listen to people at conferences, because they'll produce the ideal presentation and you think it's absolutely perfect and it's all, and the reality is it's not like that at all, and it can open your eyes. So get out there and go see as many examples as you can, where good practice is going on, you know. And I still do that now. I'll go and I'll see where somebody's swimming. Can I go and see them? I'd like to go to the US to see Reagan Smith training, but they're all in these hotshot kids are at different programs spread out all over the US. So it's not easy to go from one program to the other. Whereas if you end up in Florida and go to different programs or California, easy, because they're very close to you. But that's what I would tell myself. Have an open mind and just find out, be more inquisitive and be willing to change as I go along.
Dave?
Right, so I mean, what Ian's talking about as well is when you talk about, I call that Instagram coaching, because Instagram is just a picture of everyone's best day, and that's what you get at a conference normally. No one ever tells you the crap set or the set they do. But if I had to say things to myself, all I would say is I need to listen more, I need to speak less, I need to ask more questions. I think you can't ask enough questions. I don't mean every athlete, so I mean, I think you said this the other day, right? I mean, if you're at nationals or you're at a meet and you see someone and you want to know what they're doing, go and ask them. Because 99.9% of every coach I know who's like a decent coach, who's doing a good job, right, will just tell you what you want to know anyway. Like John said, no one's got a secret. No one keeps a secret. No one's got like a special set that makes someone amazing. And, you know, most people understand that everyone needs some help on their journey. So I would say that you just need to ask more questions. And spend less time talking, which is strange coming from me, that's for sure. But
John?
Look, going back 40 years, I'd be telling myself, you're going to have a really good time when you get to secondary school. I don't know if that makes you feel any better, Ian.
I've been 15 for a long time.
I think... I don't know that I would have done an awful lot differently, if I'm honest with you, because all of the mistakes, and some of them are howlers, and, you know, some of them are cringeworthy when I look back. You know, I was a head coach at 19, very young, certainly no soft skills or diplomacy. And but I needed to go through those abrasive years to learn that I was going to fall on my backside if I didn't treat people properly and look after them. And, you know, I remember my dad saying once to me, you know, look after people on your way up, son, because you're going to need them when you're on your way down. And fortunately, I'm not on the way down yet, but that time, you know, that time will come for all of us where there'll be those rough times and your yesterday's news. So you've got to look after everybody that's working with you. and treat them with as much respect as you can. You've got to surround yourself by trustworthy people and people with integrity, because that's absolutely key. And you need to feel that the people around you, that's other coaches working with you, and your committee, as much as you can, have got your back. Because if you don't feel that, and you're constantly looking over your shoulder, you're never going to coach properly and coach well. I also think that you've got to be careful that you don't allow yourself to become pigeonholed. Like, if we go back to 2004, 2005, I was a distance coach. That's what, you know, I was coaching Cassandra Patton and Laura Froschow and great 800 freestyle girls. And it was, oh, John Rudd's a distance coach. And then suddenly, Anthony James walked through the door, and so did Ben Proud and Aaron Rickus and Levi Lucas and whoever else. And suddenly you're a sprint coach. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that tag either. I think you've got to be absolutely open to coach the athlete that walked through the door, right? So if a 1500 freestyler walks through the door and you're not comfortable with that, you've got two choices. You either learn how to do it or you move them on. And if your 50 freestyler walks through the door, exactly the same. And you've got to be all things to all men and women if you're going to be a swimming coach, because we're in a sport where the diversity of need for athletes and the diversity of delivery that we have to be able to give at certain times is mammoth, probably more than in any other sport. You know, the athletic sprint coach in out there coaching pole vault, but we're expected to be able to deal with a 100 breaststroker and a 1500 freestyler at the same time and be equally as good. So avoid the pigeonholing, keep yourself fresh, keep yourself flexible, keep yourself agile for the athletes that walk through the door.
Excellent. I've got a question on the YouTube chat from Kim Mortimer. Kind of similar, almost linked to that question. Looking back over your whole coaching career so far, on reflection, is there one thing you wish you could have done differently?
I'll start.
Yeah.
I wish I had the program that could have seen Cassandra Patton into the Beijing Olympic Games. Right? I didn't. I had a short course pool. It was five lanes. I had 5 to 6 athletes per lane in it. And she wanted to swim world-class open water 10K. And there had to be a conversation at one point where the two of us had to recognize that she'd outgrown my program. And so the conversation was that she needed to go to Sean Kelly, because Sean had, first, he had great experience in that kind of swimming. Secondly, he had Kerri-Ann Payne there as a training partner. And thirdly, she was going to get a 50-meter pool and potentially a run lane. And she got a bronze in 2008. And I ask myself every day, if she'd have stayed in Plymouth with me, would she have got the bronze? And the answer is maybe, but nowhere near as definitely as she did get it. And from that day onwards, I said that was never going to happen to me again. That if another one came along, I was going to make sure the program was in place so I didn't have to look myself in the mirror and say, you've got to let that one go, John. So that to me was the most heartbreaking moment of my career. Now, fortunately, I was able to coach medalists later on. But for a lot of us, the one that walks through the door that could do that might be the only one in your coaching lifetime. Every day from that point forwards, I was never going to be in a situation again where the resource that I had limited my ability to deliver. And then Plymouth blossomed from there, because I just went nuts in trying to put everything in place that I needed, just in case I was lucky enough again to have another Cassie.
Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I think... I want like to move this on to a question that I had, and it relates to that a little bit about Johnson, about creating an environment where you can cater for all the athletes, or do you pass them on? And I think this is a hot topic right now, and I'd like to ask the question to Dave and John, and which is relates to the whole group, I think, and it goes back to the previous question. It's like now in the current environment. Coaches are maybe encouraged to pass the swimmers on to, let's say, national centres, when maybe the coaches have all the facilities and the skills, they have the 50-meter pools, they have the backup service, they have everything else, but the aim is to have 70% of athletes in a national center. So would these coaches here, is it dampening their ambition or their expectation to coach Olympians? I mean, would coaches in this forum be able to qualify to be a coach on an Olympic team? I mean, what's your take on that these days?
Ian, I'll step in first and then Dave can come in, right? Because I'm a performance director that looks after two national centres.
Uh-huh.
And when I coached in Plymouth, there was no way that an athlete was moving to a national centre as far as I was concerned.
That's because, the question I was asking.
Yeah, because I had the resource. I had the resource as good as a national centre, and I believed in my coaching ability. Now, any athlete where their ceiling is the programme or their ceiling is the coach, and that's evidenced by plateauing or not making sufficient progress, that's a different story. I have to have those conversations now, in the job that I'm in. And my open statement to the nation, and it hasn't changed, is if your athlete continues to make sufficient progress in your programme, I'm never going to talk to you about whether they should be somewhere else. But if suddenly they're a year or 2 years without making progress, or even worse, they're regressing, there has to be a conversation. So you club coaches, you have to make your programs bulletproof and resilient to someone suggesting that that your athlete needs to move. Because if you're continuing to see them progress, then why would anybody suggest that? So that would be my advice to you as a coach that didn't work in a national centre and wanted to see athletes onto international podiums, create a programme that makes it very difficult for anybody to justify removing an athlete from there.
I don't know how to flip that. I would say that, to be honest with you, like the kids I have don't leave because of swimming. The kids I have leave because they go to university. Although we're trying to address that, so that takes time, doesn't it? But the thing is that I think it's true though, Ian, people are encouraged to leave now. I think it's much more complicated for you to have a swimmer on the Olympic team. And I think it's complicated because it doesn't seem to be a route for a coach to be on the national team. I don't think, but I think it goes back to what we were saying right at the beginning about keeping ahead of your athlete. I think if you're doing the right thing and you're constantly striving to improve, people notice that kind of stuff. And if you're doing a good job, you don't even have to have the best swimmer in the country, but if you're doing a good job, you've got a great reputation and you're solid, hardworking. I think one thing that people do think sometimes is they think that they can work hard for like Monday to Wednesday and then like take a few days off. Don't work like that. It's never worked like that for me. It's like, it's hard work every day. And it's like trying to be as diligent and as purposeful as you can all the time. And I think if you do those things, then I think you can get something out of it. Maybe not on the Olympic team, but then the Olympic team at the moment is a different issue, right? That's to do with like selection policies and stuff like that. But when back in the day, right, if you did a good job, you stood a chance of going. And I thought that was good for me as a coach to know that I had like a career route, which is, let's be honest, right? Like we do a lot of early mornings. We do a lot of work. We have a lot of uncomfortable conversations with parents, stuff like that. There needs to be something to look forward to at the end of the day. You think yourself like, I had a great time. I had a great journey. It was a good career or whatever.
Excellent.
I think.
Some good thoughts there. Had a question come into me privately from Carl Grosvenor. So Carl, do you want to kick off with that?
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. My question is based around sports science support. You touched on the importance of that when developing international athletes within a club program. So my question was based around how you manage that and how you get the balance between giving sports science staff free range and you directing that.
Thanks, Carl. Who wants to start?
I think John, as a performance director, might be better for you to answer that one.
Well, okay.
Here's the first thing. You're in charge. You're absolutely in charge, and you make the decisions. The way that sports science should work is they're advisors, and they give you opinion, and they give you professional advice, but ultimately you make the decision. Because I'll tell you now, when the athletes stood on the podium, all of the sports scientists will be crowded around you, waving the flags and jumping up and down and going, I was part of that. And when you have a nightmare, and they don't even make the semi-final, and you turn around, you can't take the sports scientists for dust, right? So you're accountable. You're absolutely accountable for the athlete and their progress, and the sports scientists aren't. And if you allow them to be accountable, then you're making a mistake, I would say. But they'll have information in your head, in their heads, that you can never have in yours, because they're experts in that field. So if you try and be a psychologist and a physiologist and a nutritionist and a physiotherapist and a biomechanist, and you just can't do it. I just don't think you can. But what you do have is you have the swimming specific knowledge, and quite often these guys have knowledge, but it isn't quite as swimming specific as you'd necessarily want it. Even when some of these guys have been working in national centres for a year or two, they're still generic practitioners with a little bit of swimming experience. So you're the expert, and you make the decision, all right? So you're the headmaster, and everybody else are the deputy heads or the heads of department feeding in, but it's your school, and you're going to make the decision ultimately. The best way of working with these guys is to get them together. I think if you have them working in silos, you've got problems. So the notion of a multidisciplinary team where everybody's feeding in and everyone's sharing information with the coach central to that is the key model. So for instance, I would, wherever possible, want the physiotherapist stood next to the strength and conditioning coach, because we know that some strength and conditioning coaches, you know, they're full of beans and full of life, and it's all brute force and ignorance. And you need the physiotherapist sometimes just to go, hang on a minute, why are they in that position? We know this kid's got issue X, we're just going to end up with them injured. You also need the nutritionist working alongside the strength and conditioning coach, because there's certain things where the athlete needs to be fueled at a certain point for them to do certain activities in the gym. So if all of those things are happening in silos and you're not taking control of them, then I think you've got a problem. Ultimately, you get to an interdisciplinary team, and that's where they all have a little bit of knowledge about each other and each other's workings, and start to blend the sports science team together. So whilst the physio's got the athlete laid on the bed and they're giving them the MOT for the week or the rub, they're doing a little bit of the psychologist work that the psychologist has asked to try and creep in. So you get that blending. But the key message is these people are important, but don't let them be accountable, because they shouldn't be. You should be accountable, and create a situation where it's absolutely clear that they provide you with advice, but you're the one that communicates with the athlete and with the team. And the moment you start letting them pick up the phone to athletes and do things independently away from you, you've got problems.
I mean, I would 100% agree with John. For us as coaches, it's a very interesting role, because we're managers, we manage swimmers, we get the best out of them. That's what we do. We manage people. It's exactly the same in business. But we're at the hub of it, and the sports scientists feed in with all these different skills and knowledge. We can't possibly know as much as them, because that's their expertise, that's their career, that's their knowledge base. But we can know little bits. We need to know little bits so we can communicate. They need to be able to come down to our level as coaches as well, because they can sometimes be flying high up here somewhere academically. But ultimately, we as coaches make the decision of how we apply that knowledge. Now, you might say, on what basis? But we then apply the knowledge, we ask their advice, and we can decide to accept that and apply it or not. Because, as John says, the results rest on our heads. So it's how fast the person goes. Quite often, you might find that you will ask a question of the sports science, and they'll refer to all different research papers. They're all coming up with conflicting arguments or conflicting conclusions. And you go, well, hang on here. I have to make a decision. I can't go, oh yes, well maybe I'll do a bit of that, or maybe I'll do this set. No, you as the coach have to deliver something to that athlete that you think will move them on. And I'm not saying they're not invaluable by any means, because they are. And as I said before, we got some great things from Tim Kerrison. And when I first started with Roo, we used to sit in an office with some great guys like Dave Redden, who was head of sports science and medicine for the London 2012 Olympics. Some absolutely fantastic guys. And I learned a lot from them. I said, oh, can you tell us about this? What's happening here? Henrik Lacombe was another one who was an expert in sprint exercise. And when I came back from Arizona, I ran stuff by him. Henrik, what's happening here? They're assisting resistance, you know? They're assisting a resist. Like, well, what's the point of that? And he said, oh, well, they're developing power. So then I would put little things in. I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And Tim Kerrison was another one, as I said, that gave us a lot of information. And you do gravitate towards people who are probably thinking similar things to yourself, but have the more scientific background for sure. And other people, you might think, well, I'm not sure about that. I'm liking what Tim's saying, so I'll go down this route with my model. Exactly what John says, you're the person in the hub of it, in the middle of it, and you manage all of those services, and you're the one that communicates that advice to the athlete. And I know it sounds sacrilege, but obviously I mentioned Johnny and people like that. We did use some research for sure, and I would consult with different people on different, like aeronautical engineering or whatever it was going to be, on streamlining and when new suits came out, those kind of areas. But I never used heart rates, I never used lactates, I go to Greg Troy's program, I go to Eddie Reese's program, I don't see, or Frank Bush, I don't see heart rate monitors, I don't see lactate analysis going on, I don't see any of that. They get in and swim. Guys, it's not that complicated going up and down a tank of water as fast as possible. I mean, we make it more complicated than it is, or we think it is sometimes, or the sports scientists like to think it is sometimes.
Excellent. Dave, any thoughts to add to that in terms of working with sports science?
No, I think we're running out of time, aren't we?
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say today is it's a story, really. It's not about that, but it's on that same thing. Is they used to say to Bill Sweetenham, Bill Sweetenham used to be notoriously awful to the sports scientists. And they said, oh, Bill, you've got to give them more credit. And he said, the day that he sees the Olympic champion credit the sports scientist in his press conference, then he would as well. He said, they never do they? They always thank their coach. And he's the same as John. He said, when it's all going well, everyone's like, oh, look, everyone. And then when they're not, they're like that Homer cartoon where he just moves back into the bush. Exactly like that.
So we've got to kind of wrap this up pretty quick. But I want to get through another few questions before we do that. So if we can keep the answers to these questions as kind of as brief and as concise as possible.
Got that, John?
Got the wrong three on you, but that is
terrible.
Question
who
from
thought I'd be the sensible one.
Question from Matthew Cross. What are you looking for when you're building a team of coaches around you?
I'll go for that if you like, because including the centre, which evolved from the club programme or the university programme, if you want to say, when Ben and all these guys just gravitated towards that. I looked for having people who bought into the core values, but each one had a different coaching style, personality, and each one had a different coaching model that developed. So they didn't all have my thoughts. I wanted somebody that could, because maybe I didn't have ideas, or I couldn't deal with that kind of athlete. And you've heard me say a million times, that, for example, again, like you'd say, Fran and Amy, British number one and two, Fran a bit better than Amy. Fran swam with Ben and then with James. Amy swam with me, never trained together. Totally different animals, totally different work, totally different personalities. So it's good to have a variation within your coaching staff, in my as long as everybody buys into the team ethos and the direction of the team and the values of the team and where it's going. But to have different personalities with different ideas, as long as they've got the commitment and everything else, is perfect for me. And that was the original plan, really. It evolved as we went along.
Cool.
Is that a short answer?
Yeah, I'm being short.
Oh, okay.
Anyone else want to add to that?
I would agree. I would say, just like John said earlier on, I think you need people that you can trust, experience, not just agree with what you're saying, but people you can trust to tell you and be honest with you. Because it's people like that that you need. When you come back from a great meet, you need people to be honest with you. When you come back from a rubbish meet or something gone wrong, you need people to be honest with you. You need people to like, support what you're doing, but be honest. That's what you want. That's all you need.
I'll take trustworthiness, honesty, and integrity over coaching knowledge any day. Because you can add coaching knowledge, but you can't add the first three. They're the core values. And I would say that a really, really good strategy that we used was to employ your retiring athletes, because they understand the culture of the program. They understand what it is that you're trying to achieve. You're giving them something back for the services that they've given to the sport, even if it's just for 1 or 2 years before they go on to something bigger and better. Give them the green light that if they find something bigger and better, that you're not going to hold it against them. You're going to support them. That you're part of that that process to allow them to flourish and develop. But I would take those personal traits over any coaching knowledge any day.
Cool. Question from Kevin Ayres. What test sets do you do and why?
I don't do any because I'm a national performance director. Ian and Dave, over to you.
Thanks a lot for that. I don't do test sets per se, but I would monitor the training times and the rates and everything else during certain key sets. For example, the heart rate sets in particular, I'd look at how that evolved through the phasing and through the power and speed phases as we moved into the meet, and getting a little bit more rest, the heart rate times, the times for the heart rates would drop significantly, and we would know we're kind of getting ready to race fast. So I wouldn't have any particular test sets per se.
Dave?
We don't use test sets. Not at all. We have things that, like Ian said there, I mean, not quite as in-depth as Ian, but there's things that we do that we've done before, but we don't, it's not a test set per se that we would record times and stuff like that. That's not something we do.
Okay. Question from Jeff. This is mainly for Ian and John, because they worked in programs where they have older youth swimmers coming from club programs. Have you experienced athletes who have been coached out of the sport because they've done too much as an age group youth level, including weight work, etc.? What advice would you give to age group youth programs that are then sending swimmers onto universities or performance centres to avoid that happening?
I'm going to give my answer, then I'm going to have to shoot Jamie because I've got a meeting at 4:30 that I can't miss.
Yep,
so what I'm going to say is... Okay, look, this is the million-dollar question, right? How do you keep an athlete and their parents satisfied enough in their age group years to have the chance of achieving qualifying times and winning things without that being detrimental towards the long-term future of them coming to fruition in their senior years, right? And there is no model, there is no magic solution to getting the balance right. And you've got to find a way where you're sat in the middle of absolutely working on skill and technique and the things that are paramount to get right early, but at the same time doing enough work so that the county championships, the regional championships, the nationals, whatever it may be, they see light at the end of the tunnel. Because it's no good saying to a 10-year-old kid, don't worry, you're going to be terrible for 15 years, but it'll all come right when you're 25. Because that, you know, who's going to hang around? Who's going to hang around for that? So you've got to. But you can't be an unscrupulous coach where you're inflicting senior programs on young people. He says coaching a 15-year-old Olympic champion. That's slightly different, right? Because with some of the females, and particularly in breaststroke and maybe in distance free, you can push them on a little bit earlier if you can see that. But that rarely happens with the lads. So we've got to be doing the right things at the right time. And I think that's where the same in Ireland, the coach education system needs to be looked at, because we go level one coach, level two, level three coach. The level three coach is the top ranked. The level one coach is the one that's more likely to be working with the age groupers. So who wants to be a level one coach when there can be a level three? And level three means you're working with senior athletes. So our coaching structure just encourages everybody to move towards the top end of the sport. I think we need a coach education structure where there's age group coach, but you can be at, say, gold, silver, or bronze level. And then there's youth coach where you can be at gold, silver, and bronze level. And senior coach where, because some people are absolutely predisposed to working with a particular group of athletes on their athlete continuum. But we encourage people to push towards a senior end all the time, just by implication that the coaching level is a higher reward. So that would might be another conversation for another day. But look, if people have done damage to an athlete, it's really, really hard to undo that. It's not like taking a car to a garage and you put a new engine in it because the body works okay. You can't do that. So we've just got to keep educating, and having people that are willing to not live their coaching ambitions through 10 and 11-year-old kids. And that's the message that we just need to keep putting across.
Excellent. Ian, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's looking at the programme that's appropriate, not to their age, but to their level of development. And
bye, everybody.
Hey, John. Thank you, John. Thanks for your time.
And rate of improvement. So as John said, it might be that they could be one of the fastest swimmers in the world at 15, going 16, particularly in the females, as Ruta was, as Penny Oleksiak was, as Reagan Smith is in the US on the backstroke. So you've got to take it when it's there, but also be mindful that there is longevity. And from a personal experience we have coming through the doors at Loughborough in particular, a lot of times when we take them to the first meet, they'll go, oh, I was faster than that when I was 15 or 14. And we go, yeah, hey, that wasn't the person that walked through these doors. The person that walked through these doors was this. We can live with that and resurrect you by putting things in place. You've got to live with that. So I think in the age group program, you've obviously got to provide success, excitement and fun and enjoyment within your program and a positive experience at whatever stage of development they are. And I think you've got to be careful of that. That again, say, oh, well, we'll go through this structured plan, as John says, in 15 years' time, you might be a really fast swimmer. We're going to swim all this sub-max swimming of aerobic base, and we're going to swim, 15-400 sub-max all the time, every day or something, and not go fast. Well, they're going to be out the door and go to another sport. Especially now with Generation Z, you can't afford to go down those lines, I think.
Excellent. Thank you. Dave, your point of view from a coach that ends up eventually sending swimmers off to those programs?
I think, to be honest with you, I think from what I understand, from when we've been on a few chats with Mel and Dave Hemmings, and people have asked that question about, like, so what do you expect? And I think one of the things that they said was to do around the gym program. And they said, and they said, what's ideal for them is for kids to arrive at a university program who've not been exposed to the gym, who've not been had their ass kicked or squatting till they can't stand up, that kind of thing. And it just gives them somewhere to go. I think if you just concentrate on them and having a good time, making sure it's fun, giving them skills, that's all you're trying to do, right? I think that's all you can do as a club coach, right? Just try and make it fun, enjoyable, skill them up. And then when they move on to the next part of journey, it is what it is. They either move on or they don't. But as long as you do your bit, that's all you can do, I think.
Excellent.
Well, I'd add one quick thing with that.
Yep.
I think going away from the actual practical things of the work in the gym or the pool or the sets that you do, it's the values and behaviours. So gradually building in ownership of their own performance, taking ownership of their behaviours that are going to produce that performance. So it's gradually educate them in those areas, which will help when they come and they're away from home and, mum or dad are not looking after every single thing they do, packing their bag and you know, doing everything else. So just gradually building those little behaviours as we go along. Independence.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Dave, Ian and John, for your time. That's all we've got time for, unfortunately. Thank you to all the viewers that have tuned in, either on the Zoom call or on YouTube. Hope you managed to take something away from the session. I know I certainly did. But quickly before we go, just want to say thank you to our sponsors, Streamlined, who provide excellent online teaching qualifications, as well as Youth Sport Nutrition, who provide excellent nutrition supplements and products for youth swimmers. So make sure go over to our website, thepoolsidepass.com, and you can find out more information on our sponsors there. I want to hear your feedback on this session. So make sure you get in touch with us via social media at The Poolside Pass, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thank you very much for tuning in. And until next time.
Thanks, Ian.
Keep learning. Take care.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. You're welcome. No worries. Cheers. Good to see you.
Keep coaching well, guys. Fast swimming. I'll soon be here. We'll soon be back. A fast swimming trend.
You need to be drinking.